Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Breonna Taylor, an EMT, would have turned 27 on June 5th. On the night of March 13th, Breonna and her boyfriend were asleep in their apartment in Louisville, Kentucky. Three plainclothes officers barged in using a so-called no-knock search warrant, which allows police to enter without warning. Mother Jones reports that according to the search warrant, police believed a suspected drug dealer who did not live with Breonna Taylor and had already been arrested elsewhere was keeping drugs or money at her house. Breonna's boyfriend said he thought someone was breaking into the apartment, so he called 911 and shot an officer in the leg. The police responded with more than 20 rounds of bullets. They fatally shot Breonna Taylor 8 times. Bullets also flew into an adjacent home where a pregnant woman and a 5-year-old child were sleeping. In late April, Breonna's mother filed a lawsuit against the Louisville Metro Police Department. People in Louisville started taking to the streets demanding justice in May, and they continue. Author Ayanna Mathis tweeted, "I'm getting scared that we're forgetting Breonna Taylor. Those cops have not been arrested. Please remember Black women. Please, let's keep fighting for her." None of the officers involved in Breonna Taylor's death have been arrested or fired, though the FBI is currently investigating the case. Breonna Taylor's killing brings up a larger question about Black women and girls and Black trans women killed by police. One of today's guests, Professor Kimberly Crenshaw, asks, why is it that their lost lives don't generate the same amount of media attention and communal outcry as the lost lives of their fallen brothers? Kimberly Crenshaw is co-founder and executive director of the African American Policy Forum. Professor Crenshaw is professor of law at UCLA and Columbia Law School and a leading authority on civil rights and Black feminist legacy theory. The African American Policy Forum co-launched the hashtag Say Her Name campaign in late 2014. It raises awareness about the names and stories of Black women and girls who have been killed by police or have experienced police violence. Hi, Professor Crenshaw. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
We're also joined today by Eva Lewis, a Chicago-based writer, artist, and co-founder of Youth for Black Lives. Eva recently spoke with friends and family members of Breonna Taylor in an essay for Teen Vogue. It's called Breonna Taylor's Family and Friends Remember Her Greatness, and you can read it at yourcallradio.org. Hi, Eva. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Glad to be here.
Great to have you. Professor Crenshaw, I want to start off with you. I was watching the video that you posted on Twitter, and you ask that question about, you know, why is it that these girls' and women's lives do not generate the same amount of attention and outcry as the lives of their fallen brothers? You could have asked that yesterday, but you actually asked this in a TED Talk that you gave back in October of 2016.
Yes. So this has been a problem for decades, but especially in the last 4 or 5 years, in which anti-Black police violence has moved from a problem that some people think about and talk about to a movement-defining moment. So much of the concern about our inability to name Black women surfaced in the middle of the Eric Garner March. Many of us went to that march in December of 2014 with a banner with several names of Black women and girls who've been killed by the police. Some of them had been killed in the period between Mike Brown and Eric Garner, the time where there was so much energy around contesting and pushing back against anti-Black police violence. But as we were marching, men's names were being lifted up, but we were also trying to say, let's talk about these women as well. And there was just very little knowledge, number one, that Black women and girls had anything to worry about from police. And some resistance on the part of some people to integrating gender into a frame that had traditionally been thought about as an exclusive preserve of racism against black men. So some part of the challenge is to raise awareness to the fact that anti-black police violence is a problem across all genders. It's not just one coded as black male. And secondly, we have to also broaden the frames under which black people lose their lives. Breonna Taylor's lost life happened inside her home, inside her own bedroom, where many black women are actually killed. So it's a public problem. It's something that happens when black people are surveilled in public space, but it's also a problem that happens when we are in the space that's supposedly the safest space for us, and that's in our own home.
Why do you think it is taking so long for people to say their names? Breonna Taylor, the other names that we're going to talk about today. Why is it taking so long?
Well, part of it is you know, patriarchy. The lives of women, especially lives lost, just never have quite generated the same sensibility within our society at large as the lost lives of men. And I also think another dimension of it that we're just starting to talk about, and some of the mothers of the Say Her Name movement have mentioned this, when women get killed, there's a greater tendency to ask, well, what did she do? Or to put it in the way that Gina Best, whose daughter India Kager was killed, the frame is she got herself killed. She got herself killed by being with someone that the police were targeting. She got herself killed in India, in a Kager situation, by being with someone that the police were trailing. Corinne Gaines got herself killed because she had a legally owned shotgun. So it's somewhat like, I think, rape culture. When something happens to a woman, our culture provides a whole range of narratives to effectively blame her for the thing that happened to her. I think we may be seeing something similar to what's happening with black women, and it's just hard for people to hold on to the idea that a black woman can be killed based on some of the same circumstances and the same lack of concern for black life that leads to our brothers and our fathers and our sons getting killed. So we don't have the conversation about the talk that we need to give to black women and girls, because we don't really have a sense of what the content of that talk should be. That's what the challenge of the moment actually is.
Eva, what are your thoughts on this, and what would you add?
What I would add is not very different from what Dr. Crenshaw said, but I think another thing is that we are often protecting, and it is sometimes hard to advocate for yourself in a collective when you are burnt out from collective grief, mourning, and the need to protect others. And so I think, like, in general, it's just been really hard for black women and femmes to mobilize. Because, I mean, what's going around on Twitter, now I'm a Gen Zer, so we're all on Twitter, just talking. And people are just saying, like, nobody's going to advocate for us but us. And so Breonna's name wasn't going around, and it was black women who made it so that Breonna's name was circulating. And so I think the shift is kind of coming off of the entire community to advocate for us and for us to advocate for us, because historically we have really only been able to rely on ourselves.
Eva, it is such a good point on many levels, because when you think about this, Breonna was shot and killed on March 13th. This is now June 9th. And I feel like in the last two or so weeks, I started seeing Breonna Taylor's name just by passively looking at the news, right? So it wasn't like I was searching specifically for her, but her name started popping up. So that means it has taken months for her case to really hit the mainstream. And that goes directly to what you're saying.
Right. Yeah.
And it's not, as you say, it's not fair to put this all on, well, black women writers need to be writing about Breonna Taylor.
No, I think, like, I'm not going to say black women need to do this, but I think that we end up doing it.
Right.
I think, like, we wait sometimes for people to advocate for us, but at the end of the day, we can rely on us to rescue us, whether it's in parking lots when we see one of us feeling unsafe, or even now when we're like trying to say each other's names. I feel like in so many circumstances we are able to rely on us.
It's so interesting, Professor Crenshaw, because so many of the conversations that we've been having over the years, like you said, are about the talk with black boys. And of course, that is still so important. And those stories are still so important. NPR ran a piece over the weekend, and it really struck me because a young black woman was talking about her experience of going to her home after leaving her college. And police followed her. She was so uncomfortable that she got in her car and she drove about a half hour away, and the police followed her the entire time. And it hit me because I thought, wow, you hear these stories from black men, but you rarely hear these stories from black women. And she said she and her friends talk about this all the time, and something similar has happened to all of them.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, look, some of the data that came out of the really high-profile New York City police profiling black and brown people showed that black women, that there was as much of a racial disparity between black women being surveilled and stopped by police as there was a disparity between black men and white men being surveilled and stopped by the police. I think one of the challenges is we have a hard time holding on to racial disparities between women. We tend to think about racism and racial disparities only, you know, as between black men and white men, particularly when it comes to criminal justice and criminalization. But if we actually look really closely at the risk that black women face relative to white women, there's a huge disparity. Black women are one out of three of all women who are killed by the police. And they're the most likely group to not being armed when it actually happens. So when white women get killed by the police, they're more likely to be armed, more likely to be in a situation which one can objectively say that the police officer had reason to use deadly force. But many of the black women that we're talking about were not armed, were not suspected of any crime. Many of them were killed in their own homes when their parents or other family members called police for help. So Natasha McKenna was killed by police in a holding facility when she had called for help, and was taken to a holding facility and was tasered to death by six hazmat-clad police officers. That's also on tape, and it's been on tape. It's on the internet. People have seen that for 4 years. Still, the last words of Natasha McKenna, "You promised not to kill me," that's not a rallying cry. People don't even know what situation led to that. Tanisha Anderson, her family called because she was in a mental health crisis. The police showed up and attempted to restrain her, ended up doing a body slam on her and killing her, much the same way that George Floyd was killed, while the police held a gun on her mother to prevent her from answering her cries when she was calling for her mother. We don't know these stories, and part of the reason we don't know these stories is that they don't get picked up by the media. They don't get picked up by the national media. So the frames that we have for understanding what anti-black police violence looks like don't often include these moments in which black women lose their lives. So, you know, there's a saying that if the facts don't fit the frame, people forget the facts. Well, if the names don't fit the frames of anti-black police violence, people forget the names. Hmm.
Professor Kimberly Crenshaw is co-founder and executive director of the African American Policy Forum, professor of law at UCLA and Columbia Law School. Eva Lewis is a Chicago-based writer, co-founder of Youth for Black Lives, and she recently spoke with friends and family members of Breonna Taylor in an essay for Teen Vogue, which you can find at yourcallradio.org. We're going to spend some time with Eva talking about what she heard, what her conversations were like with Breonna Taylor's friends and family. And then we will continue really talking about why it is that black women and girls and trans black women are not getting as much media attention as they deserve. If you have any questions or comments for our guests, if you have a story to share, or you'd like to talk about your thoughts on this, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Eva, let's spend a little bit of time talking about what you learned about Breonna Taylor. A lot of people are really learning about this case for the first time. As I said, Mother Jones had a long piece about what actually happened. And plainclothes officers barged into her apartment March 13th. They had a search warrant. According to the warrant, they believed a drug dealer who did not live with Breonna and already was arrested elsewhere was keeping drugs or money at her house. And again, her boyfriend said he thought someone was breaking into the apartment. He called 911, shot an officer in the leg. Police responded with 20 rounds of bullets. They fatally shot Breonna 8 times. Is there anything else you would like us to know about what happened that night and about specifically the warrant and the case?
Personally, no. I don't have any information that people should know about that case. I will give you, there's a reason for that. At the time that I was asked to write a piece about Breonna, she was not getting any media coverage. The organizers who have been working with Breonna's family and friends reached out to me and asked me if I could write about Breonna for Teen Vogue. And the first thing that came to my mind was, why do we only talk about the end of people's lives and not the entirety of them? And why is the landscape and the dimension around our life only publicly acknowledged by the end of it? And so I asked Breonna's family if we could talk about Breonna for real on a deeper level. And the agreement was that I would not talk about what happened to Breonna at the end. I would leave the politics out of it in that moment so that the personal could intercept the space.
Yeah, it's such a good point because the families have to relive this over and over and over again. And in the case of black men, we know what happens with the media coverage. So let's talk about what you learned about Breonna Taylor. A lot of people know at this time that she was an EMT. As you write, she worked really hard to become an ENT. And when she needed a break from the long hours and the hard days, she became a certified nursing assistant in an emergency room. Tell us why this kind of work was so important to her.
From what I gathered from the people who loved her, Breonna was literally just a blueprint for self-liberation. Hmm. When I heard about Breonna, it was very surreal. I was like, I want to live my life like Breonna lived hers. She was born to help people. She centered community. And she was the thread between so many people. She just valued people and what they brought to the world. Breonna, she actually was trying to go back to school in the fall for nursing. Back to school, because she had already gotten some college credit. She had dreams. She wanted to be a real nurse. like I said in the article, she didn't know what type, but she wanted to help people. And she wanted to, she was excited to get married and to get her house and to continue her car collection and to just create a mechanism for herself to be sustainable through helping other people. I also included in the eulogy in a local article about a patient that Brianna had. He was paralyzed from a gunshot wound. And Brianna encouraged him and helped him to the point that he could drive on his own again. So, I mean, like, so many people are touched by Brianna locally because so many people, like, even if they didn't know Brianna's name, they knew who she was, her energy. That's what everyone keeps saying. She had an aura about her. And people around the world are touched by Brianna because of the way people talk about Brianna. And I think that's what made Brianna stand out more. It wasn't just that her death happened before George Floyd and people were fed up in the uprisings, but it's also we allowed space for Brianna's true story to be a part of the movement. People were singing happy birthday to Brianna all over the country on Friday. And that's personal. And when we allow the personal and the political to intersect, we allow for people to see themselves in an agenda and thus create agendas of their own.
Right.
Black women saw themselves in Brianna. We read about, I learned about Brianna and thought about my cousin Titi. We hear about Brianna and we think about our favorite cousin and our aunties. We see the Briannas in our lives and we're like, we have to protect each other, for real. It's not just a name that we're fighting for justice for, it's a person. And we know what she wanted, and we know what she valued. And now we're fighting for justice for Brianna's goals, and Brianna's dreams, and Brianna's values.
You mentioned the happy birthday, and Brianna would have turned 27 just a couple of days ago on June 5th.
Mm-hmm.
You also write that she was an essential worker. She was working tirelessly through the COVID pandemic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, from what I was told, she was an essential worker. Like, she, that was her job, though. Like, she wasn't just doing it during the coronavirus pandemic, but she was doing it the entire time. Yeah. And so I can imagine with what the pandemic, having that job, coming home, resting, having to go back into work probably in a few hours because of how all hands on deck the situation was, she was tired. And there's just so much irony in her serving the people during a global crisis for her to be killed after being so selfless.
Have you been in touch with the family since you first spoke with them, Eva?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I'm an organizer. So when I wrote the piece, I don't consider myself a journalist. I wrote the piece as a Black woman and as an organizer who was working with the organizers, the other organizers working with her family, and the family. It was a very intimate experience. I didn't just ask them questions, but we were on the phone for hours just talking as people.
Right. Well, well, that definitely comes through in your piece. I'm just wondering, now that people are saying her name on the streets and Brianna's story is getting so much attention, NPR also spoke with her friends, and it was really about, like you said, who she is, not necessarily about what happened that night. How is her family doing today?
I think everyone, it's bittersweet because they see everyone saying Brianna's name and they're like, finally, but they hate that people are saying her name because she died and not because she accomplished all of her goals. Brianna always said she would be great. And everyone believed that Brianna would be great. And everyone was waiting for it. She was young, so young. I'm 21. Her sister, Janaya, is 20 years old. Like, our lives, it's not possible to reach our full potential at this age. And so it's kind of just a lot of speculation. Like, what would Brianna have done if she got older? And after she became a nurse, what would have happened? How would she have affected people then if she was affecting people in this way now? So it's just bittersweet.
You're only 21. I believe three years ago, you wrote another piece called How Aggressive Policing Impacts Black Girls and Women. And in that piece, you list a number of black women, black trans women who've been killed by police, including Sandra Bland. That piece was written 3 years ago, right?
I know I interviewed Dr. Crenshaw a few years ago and say her name. I'm not going to lie. So much has happened. My brain does not compute.
I guess the point I'm making, Eva, is that, you know, you wrote this when you were just 18 years old. What, just give us a sense. I mean, I'd love to have you back with some of your friends to talk about this moment where we are. I'm just wondering, before we let you go, and then Professor Crenshaw, if you have any final thoughts for Eva, I'd love for you to jump in. What are your thoughts right now, Eva, on where we're at and what it will take to truly create systemic change? I think the last count I saw from Now This, there were over 540 protests across the country over the last 2 weeks.
An elder told me the other day that my generation is not settling for what they settled for. And that was powerful to me, because I never thought, I would never say that. I would have never said that my elders settled. But for elders to tell me we settled, it was affirming, because, you know, sometimes, you know, I could say for myself, I feel like I'm doing the most. And I feel like my friends also say, like, we feel like we're doing the absolute most right now. But the older generations are saying, we're not really doing the most. We're not settling. And there's a kind of pressure to settle, but there's just so much hope. Like, the conversations around decolonizing our minds have been there since I was a teenager, like 14 years old. So my brain isn't fully developed, and I'm able to work on decolonizing my mind. That's a lot. Like, there's a lot going on at the same time. So now, like, when I was 18, I was kind of just like, what's happening? And at 21, after the years of what's happening and work doing that internal work, and I'm still doing that internal work, but now we're able to draw up some strategies. There were folks saying abolition now for the last decade, and everyone was like, you're too radical. And now the masses are saying defund the police, abolition now. I think it takes imagination. I'm a very spiritual person, and one of the messages that I've received lately is that colonialism took our imagination. It took our ability to dream up structures and what communities can look like and what we can do with ourselves. And now people are gaining their imagination back, and everything's on the table. We can quite literally draw up something in the same way that these white men drew up something in 1776 and prior.
Before we let Eva go, Professor Crenshaw, what are you thinking as you're hearing what she's saying?
I am thinking, hallelujah. I'm thinking, I am loving hearing how decolonizing the mind as consciousness is being formed is creating a whole new generation that believes and makes it so that everything is on the table. I'm reminded of the fact that the civil rights movement in the 60s came about some, I guess, eight years or so after the generation that was the Emmett Till generation came to consciousness with a clear understanding of what white supremacy looked like. How it repressed, how it took lives. And the thought is it shaped their willingness to put everything on the line, to resist and to imagine otherwise. And out of that came the civil rights movement, the black freedom movement, the liberation movement. With that in mind and hearing what Eva just said, it made me think, this is not going to end as soon as the media decide that they're tired of it. This is shaping a whole generation, and it makes me just very proud and very hopeful about the lap that this generation is going to run around the Freedom Track.
Well, Eva, thank you for your writing. Thank you for your words. We would love to have you back on a future show with some of your friends and colleagues. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. I hope y'all have a great rest of your day and take care of yourselves, because the world is on fire and you can't do any freedom work if you don't love on yourself.
Great points. Thank you so much, Eva. Eva Lewis is a Chicago-based writer, co-founder for Youth for Black Lives, and she recently spoke with friends and family of Breonna Taylor in an essay for Teen Vogue. You can find the stories that she has written at yourcallradio.org. We will definitely have her back. Coming up after a break, we'll continue discussing these important issues with Professor Kimberly Crenshaw, co-founder and executive director of the African American Policy Forum. Professor Crenshaw is a professor of law at UCLA and Columbia Law School. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW Local Public Radio. If you have a perspective you haven't heard in today's discussion or a question that you feel needs to be answered, please join the conversation by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK, toll free. You can also send an email to yourcall@kalw.org or post a comment or question at the show's website, yourcallradio.org, or tweet us at yourcallradio.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today we are talking about the nationwide uprising that is happening across the country in small towns that many of us have never heard of. And we're really focusing today on what it will take to raise more awareness about Black women and girls and trans Black women who are either killed by police or die in police custody. We're joined by Professor Kimberly Crenshaw, co-founder and executive director of the African American Policy Forum. She's professor of law at UCLA and Columbia Law School and a leading authority on civil rights and Black feminist legacy theory. The African American Policy Forum co-launched the hashtag Say Her Name campaign in late 2014 to raise awareness about these issues and to raise the names and stories of Black women and girls who've been killed by police. You can join us at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Professor Crenshaw, one more question about the youth energy that we're seeing. We've been doing these shows for, gosh, 14, 15 years. And I have to say, the young people that are coming on the show today have just this fire inside of them. They are so connected to their history and what is happening. And they almost render us speechless with some of the things they're saying. I just wonder, since you've been doing this work for a while, what are your thoughts about the youth of today? What really strikes you about the work they're doing?
Well, I am really struck by the repudiation of traditional parameters around what's a reasonable demand and what's not. I'm really struck by their ability to channel the rage and the unwillingness to accept the limited possibilities in life into active, mobilizing. In my day, so I it takes me back to when I was in, college and later in law school. So there were groups of young people who were thinking outside the box, but there really wasn't an active movement to nurture that thinking. And frankly, when some of us took up organizing, we were roundly critiqued and repudiated by what I call the legacy civil rights organizations. And I think that had an impact. I mean, some of that work got channeled into things like critical race theory and intersectionality, but the capacity for it to really mobilize mass sort of movement making just wasn't there at that moment. So it's so exciting to see what happens when radical rethinking of the conditions of our possibility meets with generational, you know, willingness and conditions to amplify these ideas, you know, across the social sphere. And now politicians are catching up with the spirit and the energy of the moment. So I was struck last week when former President Obama embraced the movement for Black Lives, embraced Black Lives Matter. That wasn't, you know, such a salient point of convergence during 2015 and 16. So it is really showing us, as we've seen in the past, that young activists are the ones that actually, you know, push things forward. It was the youth activists that made the Freedom Riders, you know, happen. They were the ones that pushed for mass integration in public, you know, accommodations, not the senior members of the civil rights community that were somewhat more, you know, less confrontational than the Freedom Riders. So I see this as this generation's picking up the baton and saying, you know, we can do better than a 4-minute mile at this moment. Watch us. And it's very, right. It's very exciting.
I mean, you know, things are changing when Alicia Garza, co-founder of Black Lives Matter, is invited to appear on Meet the Press. She was just on Sunday. Right.
And it's a different world.
It's a different world. And it wasn't the sort of gotcha questions. It was just let her talk. It's pretty amazing to see the change in the mainstream. Let's spend some time talking about the issue here. The hashtag Say Her Name. Tell us first off where that came from, how that got started.
Well, as I mentioned earlier, many of us were engaged and horrified at the no bill, the refusal to indict the police officer who killed Eric Garner. So there were a range of you know, actions and protests, and of course there was also Mike Brown, the police officer who killed him was also not indicted. So across the social terrain, people were protesting, and we, the African American Policy Forum, joined the protest. We had met with Fran Garrett, who is one of the mothers now of Say Her Name, and Fran's daughter, Michelle Cousseau, had been killed, I think, maybe within 10 days or so of Mike Brown. So in the middle of the protests against the killing of Mike Brown, Fran lost her daughter, but there was very little media attention paid to it. Her name was not being mentioned in the protests. And Fran, in her unique way, said, you know what, somebody's going to recognize what happened to my daughter. She was not willing to let the loss of her daughter just be erased and invisibilized. So she arranged a protest where she took the coffin of Michelle to City Hall. That generated media attention. That was covered nationally. We saw that and reached out to Fran and began a conversation about what the experience was like for so many mothers who had lost daughters to police violence, and nobody was talking about it. So when we went to the Eric Garner March, we created a banner that had Michelle Cousseau and a number of other black women who had also been killed, some within that very period, and some before, and just were marching with everybody as we were chanting, you know, we're not going to take, you know, this anymore. We would put the names of the men in the chants, and then we started to put the names of the women in the chants. And some people were just shocked because they didn't know any of these names. And some people were, you know, a little miffed because there was a sense that what's a women's issue doing in the middle of this? So ultimately, we climbed up on a railing and just held the banner. And as people were marching by, we were saying, say her name, say her name. And some people began to say the names of the women. So that became a chant. We turned the chant into a hashtag in December of 2014. And throughout December and throughout 2015, people started to use the hashtag to say her name, and that was more or less a frame that many people who'd been doing activism about criminalization of black women and girls started to incorporate that work into that frame.
You mentioned some statistics, and I think this is important because this issue doesn't get that much attention. According to the Say Her Name campaign, roughly 1 out of 10 of the women and girls in the U.S. is black. Yet 1 out of 3 of the women and girls who are shot and killed by police is black. And as you mentioned, they're most likely to be unarmed when it happens. Professor Crenshaw, when you were talking about this, it reminded me of a show we did back in 2016. I can't believe it's been almost 4 years. Mm-hmm. We had on Dr. Monique Morris. She had wrote a book called Push Out, The Criminalization of Black Girls in Schools. Mm-hmm. And she writes, black girls are 16% of the female student population, but nearly 1/3 of all girls refer to law enforcement and more than 1/3 of all female school-based arrests. So it's important to connect all of these dots.
Yes, it is. And in fact, the work that led to Say Her Name in many ways began with work that we did with Dr. Morris for a report called Black Girls Matter. And it was directly related to the reality that black girls are disproportionately disciplined in school. They're disproportionately suspended. They're disproportionately expelled. In fact, the racial disparity between the punishment meted out to black girls relative to white girls is actually a greater disproportionality than that between black boys and white boys. So to the extent that disproportionate racialized punishment is a racial justice problem, black women and girls should be right in that conversation along with black men and boys. But because, once again, the framing of the problem of criminalization, the framing of the problem of disproportionate punishment has historically framed itself as a man or boy problem. And it is a problem with men and boys, but it is also a problem for women and girls. And so much of the resourcing of the research around it, so much of the policy making around it, excluded black women and girls from the beginning. And so we started the research with a commitment to include, elevate, deepen the discourse around disproportionate punishment, both in terms of what happens to women and girls, but the consequences of us not paying attention to that. So we knew and learned that girls' connection to school is often interrupted by unfair punishment. And punishment often for things that are not rule violations, but attitude violations. You know, subjective ideas about black girls being unruly or having, you know, a contentious attitude, or even violating dress codes when many times they're wearing the same things as their white female counterparts, but somehow on their young black girls' bodies look inappropriate. So we decided it was important to say these things in their own voices. We did focus groups with black girls to understand what life is like for them in the schools, understand what untreated trauma looks like, particularly in schools that have shifted their resources away from counseling to having police in schools. And we put this as a report out to elevate these concerns. So all of this is really of a piece. We don't have frameworks for understanding how women and girls, and by that I mean women and girls across the gender perspective and spectrum, experience anti-black racism. And until we have a fully inclusive understanding across genders, our movement is always going to be partial, and certain people are going to be marginalized within it.
Well, we've got about 6 minutes left, and I want to make sure we spend some time talking about Kayla Moore.
Yes.
Over the weekend, people were honoring Kayla Moore at a protest in Berkeley, and I'm just reading right now from the Daily Californian, the Berkeley paper, UC Berkeley. The family of Kayla Moore, a 41-year-old black transgender woman who died in Berkeley Police Department custody, is appealing a wrongful death suit against the city of Berkeley at the 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in San Francisco. In 2013, Moore died after being restrained by officers responding to a 911 call from Moore's roommate, who claimed that Moore, who had a history of schizophrenia and was under the influence of drugs and alcohol, was experiencing a mental health crisis. The Moore family's wrongful death suit against the city alleges that the responding officers violated Moore's rights and failed to adequately accommodate her after she was placed in police custody. So she suffered. I mean, again, I'm sorry. This is, you know, this will be triggering for some people, like a lot of these shows are right now. But she suffocated to death and was called transphobic slurs. Her sister, Maria Moore, said, quote, "Can you imagine? You're in your home, you're cooking dinner, the cops come, and within minutes you have six officers on top of you." Her last dying words were, "I can't breathe," and she was screaming, end quote. Professor Crenshaw, another name that for a lot of people, I'm guessing, it's the first time they're hearing this, Kayla Moore.
Yeah. Except for in the Bay Area, Maria, who's also part of the Say Her Name Mothers Network, has found support, and people have named Kayla Moore as one of our sisters lost to police violence. However, you know, across the nation, you know, when people say, "I can't breathe," they're not thinking about Maria, Maria's sister. They're not thinking about Kayla losing her life pretty much in the same way that George Floyd did, being swarmed by police officers who basically squeezed the very life out of her. And one of the you know, common points in both of these deaths, Maria was on our Under the Black Light show last Wednesday, the podcast of which we're releasing actually today, in which she talked about how even the police didn't want to confirm that they killed Kayla. What they tried to say was it was her pre-existing conditions that killed her. And the same thing was almost happening with, you know, George Floyd. So even being able to establish police responsibility for an encounter with a black body that was living and thriving before the encounter and not living afterwards is itself a struggle. Mm. So across the board, we see how every moment in the criminal justice system that should be in place to protect black bodies is actually colonized by the police department to make it virtually impossible for anyone to be responsible for taking a black life. And that includes black lives of men and black lives of everyone else. That is part of what the Say Her Name campaign is trying to insist upon. All black lives matter.
To that point, the National Association of Social Workers sent out a press release today. They say data indicates that 80% of police calls deal with social services issues like mental illness, homelessness, or domestic violence. 80%. Yet in some districts, only 20% of police training is devoted to these issues.
Yeah. I mean, and that's the problem that happened with Kayla. It's also the problem that happened with Michelle Cousseau. You know, an officer goes to, do a mental health check. Most of the other officers want to walk away. One cowboy of an officer basically decides he's not going to let this Michelle Cousseau tell him she's not coming out, and he climbs into, over her barricade and shoots her in the heart. You know, to just like to a hammer, everything looks like a nail. To police, every encounter with a person who they see as uncooperative is a moment for law enforcement, whether that person is breaking the law or not. So this is a consequence of the fact that the only budget that's consistently increasing is policing. So many of these problems are actually created by the voracious appetite of police and deficits that are left everywhere else. And so we know that when police are basically dispatched, when encounters between police and black bodies increase, so does the lethality of those encounters. So part of the defund the police movement is about redirecting those resources and pulling police out of social welfare moments, because the welfare of people that police encounter will not be enhanced by having to deal with the police.
Professor Crenshaw, this is a big question, and we would love to have you back to explore it further. But what do you think is the most effective way at this moment, with over 500 protests taking place across this country, to truly fight for systemic change?
Well, I think one thing is that the equation on the ground has to change. I think there's so many decision makers, policy makers, politicians who are basically just hoping to wait this out, waiting for the protests to contract, and then they'll go on with business as usual. And that's the history that they have reason to believe might pan out for them. I think the question at this moment is, how do we turn the protests into real political power? And I think that involves depriving elected officials of the option to wait this out, demanding that they take a position now, making clear that we're not going to, you know, as Eva said, we're not going to settle anymore. And that has to be clear. I think it also has to be clear that we have to bring our allies fully into the conversation, and they can't see this as a matter of bad apples. It's a bad barrel. The basket is bad. The entire container needs to be rethought. So activating, yes, because of what happened to Breonna Taylor and George Floyd, but moving quickly to understanding how these instances are made possible by the existing understanding of policing and the wide, wide range that police have to do pretty much whatever they want. Democracy is going to have to pull that back, and people are going to have to be active agents in making that happen.
Kimberly Crenshaw is co-founder and executive director of the African American Policy Forum. She's professor of law at UCLA and Columbia Law School and host of the podcast Intersectionality Matters with Kimberly Crenshaw. Professor Crenshaw, thank you so much for joining us. Thanks for your work, and we'd love to have you back to discuss these issues further.
Would love to come back. Thanks so much.
Great. Thank you. Thanks to Leah Cesarine for producing today's show, and Kevin Vance and Damian Miner for keeping the studio going. And we will continue this conversation tomorrow with John Powell, professor of law at UC Berkeley and director of the Othering and Belonging Institute. John Powell is internationally recognized as a leading expert on civil rights and civil liberties. We'll continue asking, what is the most effective way to use this moment to create systemic change for all? Thanks for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.